this microphone on, or we are supposed to?
This one.
It's on, I think, right?
Huh?
It's on?
Yeah, I could hear you.
Okay.
Can you say something?
Yes. Is it working? Yeah, I think it's working. Yeah. Okay. Hello.
Even though I expect Cole to be here, but it's kind of for a rehearsal purpose.
Yeah, that's perfectly fine. No problem. Actually, there is this small issue, like in the slides. I put some work that is not published yet.
Okay.
So, I don't know if it would be okay to share with you, because there are some figures that we plot, but we didn't publish it yet. Maybe after the presentation, I can put something in the footnote. Unpublished work or something.
Yeah, that would be. Then you are safe.
Perfect.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very good.
Okay. It's okay.
But it's, I used to have a kind of cinema.
Mm-hmm.
Is that okay for you?
Yeah, for me it's perfectly fine because I'm really from here, so it should be okay.
Okay, we are in time. Perhaps not all have arrived yet. You're missing some classmates, isn't it? How's it going? Coursework? Cross media? Coursework? Life otherwise? No, I just would like to remind you coursework for this course. I think we agreed on 11. Thanks. Is that Friday? I don't remember.
Yeah.
Friday 11th. Yes. 12 o'clock. And I think I already assigned the folder in Blackboard. I will check that. Okay. Then we continue. This week we have another three lectures, starting with Mohit on computer vision and deep learning, or introduction to multi-target tracking. I don't know whether you have met some of the first cohort.
Some of them, like one of them is actually doing projects. So
okay,
yeah,
okay.
So.
Maybe you could just start with a short introduction, who you are and what your research is about, before you start with the lecture.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, thank you so much, Peter, for inviting me for the guest lecture. So my name is Mohibullah. I am working here at NTNU as a researcher, working on different projects, EU projects and local Norwegian Research Council project. In addition to that, I am also involved in teaching and supervision of different students at PhD, master, and bachelor level. Yeah, I did my PhD in 2019 here in NTNU from same campus, and since then I'm working as a researcher. So today I would give a guest lecture, as you know, Introduction to Multi-Object Tracking. So the content or the outline of the presentation will be the following. So initially, I would like to introduce what exactly tracking is, because maybe some of you don't know what exactly visual tracking is. Maybe you are familiar with the English word tracking, but in the context of computer vision and machine learning, when we talk about tracking or visual tracking, what exactly it means. And then we will briefly, or I would say we will spend 70 or 80% of our time introducing the different building blocks and how those building blocks will be built using machine learning or computer vision techniques. Then once we introduce these building blocks, we will move ahead and we will discuss very few, I would say like through three or four very recent tracking techniques. So you will have an idea like how we can use these tracking techniques. At the end, I put a couple of demos for you so that you know how tracking could be used in real-world application. Maybe in video surveillance and animal tracking, aquaculture, many different. I have a lot of demos, so I will show that to you. And in the during the presentation, if you have any questions, please stop me. We would like to have this session as interactive as possible. So it could be, you know, like kind of informal lecture, kind of tutorial. Okay, so what is object tracking? First of all, it is a very active research field in computer vision. It refers to localizing and giving a unique ID, whether it could be an alphabet or a number or anything, but some unique identifier to a single or multiple objects. And the objects is up to you. You can define it. What is the potential targets of interest for you? From the time they appear in the field of view of a camera until they leave the field of view of a camera. So that's the formal definition of tracking. You define your object of interest, people, human, cats, dogs, cars, whatever you want, and you localize it. By localizing, I mean localizing the spatial position, like where exactly it is in the field of view of a camera, and then giving the same unique ID until it is in the same field of view of a camera. So applications, it has, I would say, many different domains. It's actually difficult to put everything on one slide, but you can find applications of tracking everywhere, some of them specifically on video surveillance. So for example, safety of public spaces, crowd management, natural disaster detection, or disaster management once a disaster happens. So how you can, for example, very recently you maybe have seen the accident that happened in South Korea, the stampede, the crowd congestion. So these kind of algorithms can help. For example, you can have an idea how many people is moving and how many people are concentrated in specific places. So video surveillance, one domain. Then we have the application in computer-generated images and gaming. For example, we can use the tracking algorithms for match moving in augmented reality and mixed reality, and also evaluating the performance of different players. Sports player, maybe football or some other player that you are interested, you can keep track of the player. And based on the information, you can extract how a player is performing. Similarly, in autonomous navigation or autonomous robots, we have application in navigation. You may ask, like most of the autonomous vehicle nowadays we have, they are based on radar. That's true, because radar is like more robust specifically to image noises. Like for example, if it is a cloudy or the view is not clear, then vision-based technique doesn't help. But radar-based technique works well. So most of the autonomous navigation we are having now, it is based on radars, but the visual-based tracking or visual-based navigation is also getting quite popular nowadays. And nowadays we will have, maybe in the future, we will have heterogeneous sensor to do the robust navigation. Similarly, in industrial automation, it has potential application. And then in agriculture, I would emphasize more on the agricultural domain, because this is the field where we are working like from last 2-3 years. So it has applications in plant phenotyping, aquaculture, animal behavior analysis, and genotyping. Like, what are the basically selecting the animals for breeding purposes using tracking techniques. It is also considered as a challenging problem. You guys are maybe taking courses in Color Lab, so you may know like what these terms are. Like, for example, when the light is changing, so variation in the light intensity, the appearance is basically changing a lot abruptly. For example, if you want to see a person in daylight and then at night, the appearance will be really, really different. Similarly, the rapid motion of objects that we want to track makes it quite challenging, and also the complex object shape. Usually when we want to do tracking, the objects are quite articulated. In case of humans are like moving every second, I would say, the pose is getting changed. So at every instant, the shape of object is getting changed. So because of complex object shape or articulation, it becomes a little bit difficult. Similarly, the occlusion and clutter problem is quite normal that we are facing in this kind of domain. Occlusion simply means that when two objects are like blocking each other, and clutter is when you cannot differentiate between the object of interest and the background. In addition to that, we have the unknown number of targets, so it's an unconstrained problem. We cannot put some constraint on how many objects that we want to track. Anyone can come in the field of view of a camera, and anyone can go at any instant of time. So unknown number of objects or unknown number of targets make it quite challenging. Maybe this I will introduce later. Now I will mainly talk about the building blocks. As I said, this will be actually the core of the lecture today. And we will talk about what are the possible techniques or what are the algorithms that we can use for each building block. So the most important one for tracking is basically the appearance model. And when we talk about the appearance model, we simply mean what kind of feature descriptor or what kind of feature model should we use to represent the object that we are tracking. Like how to represent the target of interest for a computer. How should the computer see it? So that essentially comes in the appearance model. The second most important component is the detection and segmentation model. And the idea of detection and segmentation is how can we localize the object of interest in the field of view? Like how can we separate it, like this is the object that we want to track. So basically separating the object of interest from the background is your detection and segmentation model. In case of multi-object tracking, we also need an association model. And by association simply mean that let's say we have a frame, let's say at T, and we have many objects. So if you want to have a detection model, you can have a multiple detection. But then across the frame, like in the temporal domain, how can you associate the targets which are exactly the same? Like for example, person 1 is appearing in frame 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So how you will associate this person across the frame in the temporal domain? That is given by the association model. In addition to that, we have more, I would say, not extremely important component, but still they are also, they contribute in giving better performance for tracking. So we have the motion model, where you try to put some constraints on how a given object should move in a scene, like whether it could be moving with a linear motion or a non-linear motion or completely abrupt motion. So there are ways actually to model like how an object should be moving in a scene. Then we have the interaction model and we have the mutual exclusion model. Interaction model simply means that if two or more than two entities are moving in a given scene, whether they should be interacting with each other or not. So we have, for example, some model called social force model, which is specifically for humans because humans are social species. So, you know, when they are moving, they are always having some sort of interaction with each other. Similarly, we can have like the crowd pattern analysis model. Like if there is a group of people, then we can essentially apply the crowd model because there are actually theories for the crowd pattern. Like usually if there is a crowd, if one person in the crowd moves in a specific direction, the crowd usually follow that direction. So this behavior is true for a group of birds, a lot of fishes. They're also following this. And this is true for humans as well, or group of sheep as well. Like if they are in a crowd, if one of them is moving in a specific direction, the whole crowd would follow it. So this is quite, I would say, coming from the social sciences or those domains, so there are very well-established theories on that. Similarly, we have the exclusion model, which simply means that at a given particular spatial position in a given time, at one spatial position, you cannot occupy two people. So that's basically the trajectory level exclusion and detection level exclusion. We will come back to this later on. Now we can start a little bit about, because this lecture is kind of tutorial for you guys. So let's say if you want to understand what tracking is and then want to use machine learning or deep learning. So it's not like you want to use deep learning for tracking. There are actually a lot of building blocks. So for each building block, you can use either machine learning or classical approaches. So let's say it starts from the appearance model. So appearance model simply means that you have these basically people that you can see here. This is the result that you get usually after applying the object detector. You get the bounding boxes. So now how you can represent this object? So of course, there are classical ways as well, and there are machine learning ways as well. The classical way is basically using the feature descriptor. Maybe you guys have taken basic courses in image processing and you know what the feature descriptor are. So for example, the classical feature descriptor are the handcrafted features, where we have two categories: the safe surf, the key point based features, and we have the global features, which is like histogram of oriented gradient, local binary pattern, and motion based descriptors like optical flow. So how we can use these handcrafted features or global features to model the appearance? For example, in case of key points, you can apply your key point descriptor on a given object, a human, let's say, and the key point descriptor is essentially giving you some key locations, maybe a fixed number of points. Like usually these are like sharp edges, boundary point where there is the appearance is changing abruptly. So these are the kind of points that you will get usually from the key points. And these key points are, there are many key point descriptor. You may have known, SIFT, SURF are quite famous. Then we have BRIEF, we have VLET, and we have actually maybe thousands of feature descriptor out there. But the idea is, whatever feature you want to use, if it is a key point descriptor, it will give you a specific number of key points on the object of interest that you want to track. On contrary, if you want to use a global descriptor, then it is not specifying or characterizing the whole object by a few key points, but it is characterizing the whole object by using the whole patch. So let's say if you want to talk about the histogram of oriented gradients, it tried to extract the edge features and then it tried to calculate the histogram of the orientation of the gradients, and based on that it gives you a descriptor, and then you linearize that, and that's your feature descriptor. That's the representation for that particular object that you want to track. Similarly, local binary pattern, you may have known, it's specifically a descriptor that is used to extract some pattern. It's based on binary descriptor, so you know, you try to move in a circular and clockwise or anti-clockwise way, and then you just try to make bit 0 and 1. It's not the, I don't want to go in the detail of that, but if you are interested, you can read about it, how you can extract. But the idea is, this kind of descriptor essentially extract the object representation using the whole patch. The whole patch is used to extract the descriptor for it. Similarly, if you want to talk about the motion descriptor, so we have the optical flow. Optical flow is a kind of motion descriptor that is usually calculated between two frames, T1 and T plus 1, let's say. And the idea of optical flow is it is giving you the motion content or the motion vectors between two frames. Let's say if there is an object that is moving, so how the motion, or what are the pixels that has been moved compared to the previous frame. Then, of course, there are many different ways of calculating optical flow. We have Horn and Shunk. We have the Farnbeck, and many techniques. Like, it's optical flow is a research field by its own, actually. So let's say this is a video of a person playing tennis. And if you want to calculate the optical flow, so you can see the frame below. That's the content, like how this person or how the pixel has been moved. The color-coded content shows the magnitude of the motion. Like, for example, more motion will be kind of red, less motion will be greenish or bluish. Yeah, some more descriptor if you want to localize or see how exactly the motion field or motion vectors is moving. So, for example, this is one of the data set that we collected. at a animal farm in Hummer, and you can see when the animals are moving, these motion vectors, the blue one, these are actually the motion field, like the motion vectors that show the direction of motion, like how this animal is moving. You can use the same optical flow. You can use the same optical flow to basically kind of establishing the temporal evolution of objects, like how the objects are moving in the temporal domain with some little bit history as well. So these are the classical way, I would say, only to model the feature representation, how we can represent the objects for a computer. But the question is why they are failed, why no one is using them, you know, like no one is using this handcrafted feature in computer vision or machine learning domain. So I have some examples for you, which may be a bit easier to make it to make my point. So for example, if there are objects that are very different or very similar and difficult for a person to differentiate, like for example here you can see apple and this owl, it's looking very similar. Similarly, puppy and bagel, and see, sheepdog and mop. So difficult to see, or at least a little bit deceiving as well. And this as well, chicken and Trump, it looks very similar. So if you want to apply your classical feature descriptor, whatever descriptor you want to use, color descriptor or hog or LBP or VLAD or brief or whatever descriptor you want to use, the motion descriptor you get will be quite similar. So it will be difficult to differentiate between these objects. And then when it comes to tracking, a good feature descriptor should be able to give you differentiation between different objects. So if they are very similar, you cannot basically track. Then we have the other category of features, learned features. So here comes the deep learning part, how we can use deep learning or machine learning to model the appearance of the target. You already know what deep learning is, or you may have taken some courses, so it's basically hierarchical models where different layers are organized in a hierarchy, and then we use essentially a lot of data to optimize or to tune the parameters. So the idea of learned features, or the way learned features are different from the classical feature, is in the classical feature, you are essentially using some mathematical formula. For example, in the case of hog, you are essentially using the edge information, and then you are basically calculating the histogram of the orientation of the edges, and that's your feature descriptor. So you have this predefined rule, you know. Irrespective of the content of image, you apply those rules, and you get your feature descriptor. In case of machine learning, deep learning, there is no rules, actually. You just design your model, and then you have a lot of data. You just feed the data to your model, and you let the network to learn the abstract information. Maybe those abstract information will not be meaningful for you, for us, for a human, but it is very meaningful for human. And then there are actually techniques to visualize what the network is seeing after feeding them with a lot of data. So for example, if you want to visualize some of the kernels, this is, you can see, as I said, the networks are hierarchical in nature. So every layer is learning something. What every network layer is learning, they are learning different features. Like, for example, if you talk about the low-level layers, they are kind of learning color descriptors or circles or edges or something, like very low-level descriptors. As we go deeper and deeper and deeper in the network, then the level of abstraction in the features are getting more complex. We don't know. It's kind of hallucinated. This is one of the earlier network feature visualization of AlexNet. Then if you want to use the visualization of more complex networks, like for example Google Inception Net or many other networks, you can see that these are the features that maybe for a human it's not very meaningful, but it's like, for example, here in the last layer, you can see that this network has been trained on ImageNet. So there are 1,000 classes, a lot of classes. So you can see that the network is actually seeing objects, like real things, just like human, maybe not like exactly human, but it is actually seeing things that that looks like human in the form of hallucination. So this what makes these kind of networks quite robust for, let's say, image classification or differentiating between different objects, because now there are no mathematical formula, there is no rigid principle that I apply on a given image and then I get my descriptor for it. You feed a lot of data to the network, and the network is seeing, like, okay, how different shapes are, how different people are, how different objects are, and then based on that, it can easily differentiate that. So that's the visualization of different, I would say, kernels or different layers. How we can use that, let's say a CNN or a deep network for modeling the appearance of a target. So that's a simple way. You have your frame, let's say. You have your object detection. You get the bounding boxes. Now, instead of applying some handcrafted feature or color descriptor or whatever descriptor, you give that small patch, not the whole frame, but the small patch to your network. Whatever is your network, there are, I would say, 10,000 network nowadays out there. But whatever network you have, you give that to your network, and the network is basically going through different layers, and at the end, it will give you a nice feature vector. If we talk about specifically to the CNN, maybe you know that there are two functional blocks. So the first block is essentially responsible for extracting the feature, and then the second block is essentially responsible for doing classification, specifically if we talk about the classification. But in case of tracking, we don't need classification, so we use only the first functional block, which is basically doing the feature extraction. So that's a nice depiction, like how we can use a CNN, let's say, for extracting the feature vector. And now this feature vector, you can use it for many other applications, like tracking. This is your target representation. Many other applications as well.
Do we do this in real time? The feature extraction?
Or? Yes, if your application, or if you want to do tracking in real time, everything is done in real time. Let's say if you have a visual scene, there are four or five objects moving. So we do this step for all the objects in every frame. So, you know, it's computationally expensive.
So it does not take that much time to extract features from the
convolutional layers? I will come back to that point. If you want to use a super deep network, it takes time. But then there are techniques, like, for example, one of our work, I put it here in the slide, I will explain that, because then you can play a little bit with the techniques and get it in real time. It's a good point, but we will talk about it. So far, you see, we are talking about the different building blocks, and so far we only covered like the appearance model. Now we come to the other building block, which is basically the object detection and segmentation. All these building blocks that I am introducing here, maybe you will be thinking that they are a research field or research topic by their own. That's completely true. There are people who are working only on object detection. There are people only working on segmentation. But let's say if you are interested in tracking, you have to use all of them. You cannot skip any of it. So tracking is, that's why it's like, you know, it's a combination of different building blocks, low-level building blocks. So the second and I would say extremely important component for multi-object tracking is the object detection and segmentation. When we talk about the object detection, you know, object detection essentially is basically the localizing the object of interest in a given frame. And usually the localization is given in the form of bounding boxes. You just enclose the object in a bounding box. And segmentation is basically separating the pixel of an object of interest from the background. So technically there are different techniques or different types of segmentation: binary segmentation, semantic, instance, and panoptic. Object detection is like just object detection, but how to do it, there are different ways. There are two-stage method, there are single-stage methods. This is specifically for the deep learning part. But this is a simple timeline, which is introducing like how object detection technique has evolved from, let's say, from 2001 until now. So initially, we basically use the feature descriptor. For example, one of the very popular or one of the very first object detector was based on Hogg histogram of oriented gradient. They try to use the Hogg descriptor from patches of images and then use support vector machine. It was one of the popular classifier back like in the days, maybe 10 years ago. And then each extracted patch, the extracted histogram of oriented gradient was classified as there is an object and there is no object. And then they use the non-maxima suppression to basically get the objects or the bounding boxes that really have the objects. So this was early 2001, you know, like 2004. Then we have the deformable part-based model. This was also another quite popular model, non-deep learning-based. And then we have 2012, after the introduction of AlexNet. And we have more techniques now. So after 2012, deep learning-based technique come in two flavors, the one-stage approaches and two-stage approaches. If you are interested, you can read more about these, but the brief difference between these two is single-stage method basically take an image, give you bounding boxes at the output. Two-stage methods take the input image, first use another network, usually called the region proposal network. That's the usual name. There are more names as well. The task of region proposal network is like it tries to come up with some potential locations, potential bounding boxes, which may or which may not have objects. And then in the second stage, there is a classifier network which tries to classify that this bounding box has object, there is no object. So this is the brief difference between these two. This is one of our work. Like nowadays, the most popular or state-of-the-art object detector is called EfficientNet. I think it was introduced by Google last year. It's a very complex model, but it is giving a very nice result. So in our application, for example, we use the EfficientDetect to do the peg detection for our project. So you can see this is the data that we collected in a form in Hummer. It's a real data. And the results are quite good. We got the like accuracy more than 95%. It's quite accurate results for the for our application. Of course, there are some errors as well. Like for example, sometimes you see there is this bounding box with no object. That's the misdetection. Like there is nothing, but it is showing you. But in cases when the animals are quite, when there is less occlusion, we are getting quite good results. It is important to emphasize that the original model is trained on COCO dataset, which has like around 300,000 images or more, because the dataset is all, you know, they are already always getting updated. People are adding more and more and more images, but roughly the annotation or the images they have is around in the order of thousands or 100,000, more than 100,000. But in our case, of course, we cannot, we don't have the luxury of like getting 100,000 images, so we train this model with only 1,600 images. And with only 1,600 images, the results are quite good. Slightly detour, just to give you another perspective of this object detection as well. So you have seen like this is an integral part of tracking as well. But we can use detection and segmentation for other applications as well. This is actually another project that we are working on. And it's about basically cattle weight estimation. So this is the data that we got from a real farm, like a cattle farm here in Norway. They use a depth camera as well. So in capturing, we have the RGB image and we have the depth images as well. And then we propose actually our network, one of our network for doing the segmentation. So with that segmentation, what we can get is automatically, basically, we can approximate the weight of a cattle. So without putting the animal on a balance or anything like that, you just take an image at the top view, do your segmentation, and then you have other networks to do the approximation for the weight, and you can do that as well. So apart from tracking, such kind of models can be used for other techniques as well. Yeah, so a little bit more work on segmentation. That's how it looks like if you want to apply like segmentation on the real sequences. This is like another model that we proposed. Consists of different encoder and decoder architecture with different initialization to do the peg segmentation. Yeah, some more demos. Let's say for the humans as well. And then for... again, pigs, not like, let's say, so I talked about detection, which was basically putting a bounding box across the animal, and then I talk about the segmentation, which is basically classifying the individual pixel, but if you want to combine that, then you get this kind of result. You have the bounding box, and you have the inside the bounding box, you can even do the annotation, or the pixel, the pixel that corresponds to the pig head. So this is, we were only interested in the pig head, not in the whole animal, so the results are quite good, but this is trained on a very, very small data set. Let's say if you want to combine object detection and the segmentation, then we can get quite good instant segmentation result as well. Like, for example, in this, we use the segmentation model and the model for the segmentation. So initially we detect the animals in the form of bounding boxes. Then individual bounding box is given to a segmentation model, essentially a binary segmentation model. And then whatever segmentation mask you get, you use that for that particular object. And then for the next, you use another color. So at the output, like for the whole frame, if you see, the colors will be different and you get the instance segmentation result. Yep. So far, we have covered two components. First, the appearance model. The second, the detection and segmentation. If you want to use detection model, and like this is one of the results that we get with the one of our tracker, you can see that this bounding box result is nice. It's okay. But when you have specifically the top view, this bounding box is getting like quite bigger. And if it is getting bigger, you see it is sometimes incorporating the other objects as well, which is not good because you have a lot of background pixel. If you want to use the appearance model, you have a lot of useless pixels to do the association. So this is like not a good thing, you know, it's a bad thing if you want to use like a bounding box specifically for this kind of application. Then what we did, we proposed to use a key point detection. Still, exactly it is detection, like we want to localize the animal or the person or whatever it is. But instead of using a bounding box descriptor, we don't want to use bounding box. We want to use the individual key points. And then when it comes to key point, you have to define what is key point. Like, for example, what is the most important key point that you want to detect for, let's say, for a given animal. So what we did, basically, we defined 6 key points for a pig, let's say. And we said that 2 ears, nose, neck, back, and tail. These are the most important key points that we are interested in. We want to detect these key points because once we have this detection of key point, we can do better tracking. So then again, when you want to do the, you know, it's getting deeper and deeper now, but if you want to do the key point detection, there are again many different ways of doing it. Broad categories, you can do the bottom-up approach or the top-down approach. If you want to use the bottom-up approach, you essentially give an input frame, and at the output, you get the key points. In the top-down approach, before doing the detection of the key point, you have to have an object detection. And the object detection is giving you a bounding box, and then the bounding box is given to a key point detection model where it localizes the individual key points. That's a very broad explanation. So, of course, we work a little bit on the both categories, like the bottom-up approach and the top-down approach. The famous model in this domain is OpenPose, which is quite famous, initially designed for humans, but you can extend it to other objects if you want. Then we have the HR network, which is called the Deep High Resolution Representation Learning. It has actually a lot of branches with different resolution, and the idea is in order to preserve the resolution of the input frames for future extraction. Then we have the transformer-based model, Transmos. All these models can be used basically for the key point localization. This is one of our recent work where we use the general attention and spatial attention for doing the detection of the, doing the key point detection and then consequently using a Bayesian filter for tracking. So this is if you're interested, you can read the paper. This is only specifically for the key point detection. So you have seen the result of tracking using the bounding boxes, how it looks like. If you want to use result of the tracking using the key point, that's how it looks like. So you can see now we are not using the whole bounding boxes, but we are basically using only the key points that we extracted with the key point model to do the tracking. So these results are much better than basically the bounding boxes. Some more results where we basically use the key points instead of bounding boxes for doing the tracking. Yeah, so more results with the detection. This is actually the detection results from one of the earlier models. Like, I think it is the deformable part based model. This is non-deep learning based. So you can see here, like, given that it is not based on deep learning, so the classical approach is always confusing this tripod with the human because it has 2 legs and human has 2 legs. So, you know, it is confusing that with the human, even though it is not human. Yeah. More results with the sports player. So in some cases, it's nice, but, you know, if there are occlusions and objects are not nicely visible, then we have a lot of problems. Yes. So we have successfully covered two components for our tracking, the detection and the appearance. Now we can discuss a little bit about the motion model. It's another quite important component actually for tracking. So usually when we want to do tracking of a given object, we have some precondition, like we either assume then the object will be moving with a constant velocity or constant acceleration. So if it is like that, then we have the kinematics equation of motion. Maybe you have studied that in your high school physics. X is equal to x naught is equal to v naught t. X is basically the displacement, and x0 is the initial displacement, v0 is the initial velocity, t is the t. Similarly, using the velocity equation, v is equal to v0 plus at. So you know this kind of equation. So if you want to use either constant velocity or constant acceleration model, you can hard-codedly program this kind of motion model. Like, this is your assumption that how an object will be moving in a visual scene. But again, of course, you can also use deep learning to model the motion. And how you can use that, we have the CNN models. These are basically models that we use to learn the spatial features. But we have other variants, like we have the LSTM, long, short term memory networks, where the network essentially learns the temporal correlation between different frames. So we can use, let's say, LSTM network or gate and recurrent neural network to learn the temporal dependencies between different objects. And then rather than hard, like using the kinematics equation of motion to model the motion of different objects, we use the data. Like, you give a lot of video data, of course, not frames, but like video data. And then from the video data, we can learn how different objects are moving in a scene using these kind of models. So deep learning can help in this way here. Now coming back to different, let's say, models, like what are the some techniques that we can use to do the tracking. So for example, for single object tracking, a simple network, which is quite effective, by the way, is the Siamese neural network for tracking. And the idea of this Siamese neural network is you have the two branches. In the beginning, I introduced like how you can use the CNN or a deep neural network for feature extraction. So now whenever you are reading a deep learning paper, if you see a feature extraction, you have to understand that this is most probably a CNN. And only the first functional block of a CNN, like only the layer which is responsible for feature extraction. So if you see such kind of figure, you understand that this is a feature extraction based on deep learning. So Siamese network, how it is doing tracking? It can only use for single object tracking. So you use basically an object, let's say at frame t0, and then you use the same, you use like a frame where the object is present but in a different time instant, let's say t plus 1. And you try to feed these two frames to a network, and the network is trying to find out like where the object is in the previous frame and where is the most probable object in the next frame, basically using some local neighborhood search. So with this kind of search, single object tracking is quite nice. It's very simple technique, but it's quite effective. Works well for single object tracking. Similarly, there are techniques where they try to combine tracking, learning, and detection. Because when we want to do the detection, we usually do detection in frame-by-frame base. We don't incorporate any temporal information. But if you want to do tracking as well, you have the additional component of the temporal information. So this model, the TLD tracker, what it do is it is trying to do robust tracking using detection, and using detection tracking. Like, for example, it can be used to correct the detection failures using tracking results and tracking result for the detection in a kind of loop. So that's also one of the earlier techniques, I would say, for doing the robust. And it works well, but for each instance or for each object, you have to incorporate one TLD instance for each object. So technically, for multi-object tracking, it's not like very well. Then we have the Bayesian tracker, or tracking based on Bayesian filtering. which essentially is a probabilistic filter which tries to combine the prior, the likelihood, and come with the posterior. Now, how you can combine or how you can model your prior, your likelihood, your posterior, it all depends on your definition, like how you can define prior. So one possible way or one nice explanation for that is basically you define the initial known position of an object, like the spatial position, as your prior. Then the bounding boxes or the detection result that you get from either detection or segmentation model, that's your likelihood. And then by using a motion model, you try to combine with the likelihood. And then by combining these two components, these two probabilities, using the bias rule, you get your posterior. And posterior is nothing but it's the known spatial position of a given target in the next frame. And then it works in a kind of loop. So, you know, you iterate, and in the next, the posterior that you have in this frame becomes prior for the next frame. So that's how you just keep tracking and iterating. Yes, so little bit results. That's like for the single object, but you can see how it looks like. You see it's a quite challenging situation, and the idea here was to track the face of the baby deer. Similarly, this ski guy, there is a lot of abrupt motion changes, object shape changes, but with a good tracker, you can still keep track of the place or the region that you want to track. Surfing, and see the results. Tracking can be used for other applications as well. So this is one of our EU project that we are working on. And the idea is basically to recognize the facial emotion recognition for Parkinson patients. So for example, we have like cameras installed in old houses, and we can detect the faces. And then inside the faces, we can see what kind of expression the person is having at any given instant. So they are going through different therapy sessions, and at least you can understand like how they are experiencing a different instant. This information is quite useful for the doctors, like they can understand their inside, and based on that, propose some more therapies. Yeah, should we take a break or continue?
Yeah, normally we have a break of 45 minutes, so I think it's time.
Yeah, maybe before starting this new, I would say, building block, we can take a break and then we can continue.
Yeah. Then 15 minutes,
yeah.
We start 12:15.
Sounds good.
Okay. Thank you.
Hello. Yes.
I think you just checked the overlay file you shared. So do you think this is okay? I mean, if I'm going through the right track.
Yes, but you know what? I understand it could be difficult, you know, like for example, let's say going through or finding papers which are having this overlapping data set. So what you can do, like for example, in case of tracking, we have this benchmark. Let's say.
Yeah, I just wrote it down the data sets I could find from the papers I have gone through so fast, just to make a list. So, for example, the papers I have covered so far in Capsule Network, they have included these data sets, and even none of them actually overlapped for any of the papers.
Actually, these two are for classification.
The original Capsule Network worked on this, and SIGCAPS, that was for object detection of segmentation, they actually use this data set, and the rest of the papers actually use these data sets, and I'm not even much familiar with these.
What we can do is cohort segmentation benchmark. You know, like, if we can just check a benchmark, a benchmark is basically a kind of leaderboard where you can see the results of different, like a same data set on different models, like for example this. So from here you can just take the results. Like for example, let's say this is FD Swin V2G. This is, I think, I assume it's a transformer based model for some segmentation or something. So you can just check the paper and see which data set they are using, and then most probably other techniques here will be using the same data set. So you know, it's good to have at least 2-3 tables of results in your paper. Then you know it's easier you are not required to run everything by your own, but of course if you can just take the results from the papers and put it here, that's quite nice. In worst case, what you can do is you can create like a table. If a technique is using a particular data set, you can only fill the results of that data set, and other techniques are not using the data set, so you can just leave it blank, or you know, put like a dot or something.
If I want to present the results just for Capsule Networks,
But it's you're not only covering Capsule, there are many things, other things as well, don't you think?
I actually searched for Capsule Networks that mainly focused on object segmentation. So I'm not sure if I am doing the search properly. For example, when I searched geometric deep learning, I took only the papers that have focused on segmentation.
Yes.
I found like a lot of papers, but those were for classification or...
Because I mean, geometric deep learning is a generic term. You can use it for anything.
Yeah, and Capsule Network has also worked for the survey paper I read. It has like 30 pages. It has tons of papers. But only selected the one for segmentation.
But in the survey, they also have the... Don't you think they have the results or...
Yeah, they have results, but the original one, they have used the MS dataset. The SIGCAPS, they have used this Luna 16 dataset for this medical.
And this dataset is only used by these guys, no one else.
They have compared this with UNET and UNET2, but they are not using the Capsule Network.
But you know, like for example, anyway, you can use the result these, like, you know. For example, capsule-based technique is giving this result. And then UNET, because it's always good to compare with UNET, because this is a kind of, you know, the benchmark. Everyone knows it. If someone is working in segmentation, he definitely knows UNET. So, I mean, anyone can ask you, like, okay, this network is giving this result. What about the benchmark? Is it giving some better results with, let's say, a UNET or something, you know? So include these results, even though they are not like... but reference them, you know, like, so for example, you took these results from this paper, so you can just add in the reference that the results are extracted from this given paper. Then I think all is good. And if you follow this technique, I think you can find quite a lot of results from many different...
All of them have provided results, but just the data sets are not the same. I mean, if I want to just cluster, like, individual methods, capsule networks together, geometric deep learning together...
But generally, on capsule network, the... there is not a lot of papers, actually. It's very
it's
few.
Quite new, yes.
So, it's not new. I mean, it's introduced in 2018. But for some reason, there are not many papers. Maybe because there are better models now. So, So people don't want to work in this domain. But whatever it is, I think it's good to have some documentation. Like for example, the way you are doing it, it's nice. And if you can't find comparisons with other techniques, fine, just take these results, because at least it is good to show how capsule network is performing with classical deep learning, or classical, you know, approaches. So it's always good. I think if you do like that, what you can do is the following. For example, you can select 5 or 6 data sets. From each data set, you can find 5-6 comparisons. Like for example, this is Lunar or Luna?
Luna.
Luna, like Luna data set. They did comparison with the
Luna
capsule network. So you can just take the whole. And then this is basically the comparison of Luna data set with the state of the art.
Okay.
Then you take, let's say, other data set. Let's say Coco. For Coco, I'm pretty sure you can find a lot of
I mean, in capsule network, I couldn't find Coco anywhere.
No. Capsule network, only this is enough.
Yeah.
If you go for, let's say, the
geometric one yet.
Yeah, don't spend too much time on it, actually. Just this is enough. Then let's say you take a technique which is based on geometric deep learning. Take a kind of like a survey paper or a very big paper, right? They will have comparison with 5-6 techniques as well, using some common data set, because, you know, it's in their paper. So then you take that data set, that this is, let's say, CIFAR or MNIST data set, and list all the comparison. With geometric technique, classical technique, that's enough.
And for capsule network, I have finalized these papers, the SIGCAPS, which one you gave me, and I have already summarized this one. It was video CapsNet. And there says capsule VOS, it's from the same author. And other one, there was one.
Three papers, I think it's quite good.
Okay. And I was worried that probably I'm only able to like cover all of the 4 topics. So first of all, I'm going through capsule network and geometric deep learning. And then if I can manage, then I'll just...
I think these two are okay. Because
geometric deep learning, I found a lot of papers for segmentation.
Yeah, this
and all of them are from the conferences that you mentioned.
Yeah, that's a good thing then. I think at this stage, you can only focus on these two.
Okay.
The caps and the geometric one, these two are enough. If you can discuss them a little bit in detail as well, like how the model is designed, or what are the, you know, like the building blocks of the individual model. Like for example, if you talk about the CNN, then we have this convolution and, you know, pooling and batch normalization, these are the building blocks. So the same is true. If there is a model which is based on geometric deep learning, what is the building block, you know?
Okay.
I assume, I don't remember, but there is this aggregation function. If I remember correctly, that's their building block. But you can see as well, like for example, if you want to use geometric deep learning for segmentation, how an object or how a frame is represented. For geometric deep learning, whatever we want to process, for whatever application, we have to convert our input in the form of a graph. So how the graph is converted, you know? There are different techniques, like either using SuperPixel or what kind of techniques they are using for converting a given frame into a graph. So I think if you add those kind of details and do, let just take the comparisons with the other papers, that's more than enough. You don't need to go to GateIt or other techniques as well. Because, you know, transformer, that's another ocean. Everything is
yeah,
so
I
big.
Found transformer like huge, so that
it's too big, yeah, it's too big. It would be nice if you can maybe focus only on one thing from the beginning, but now, given that you already covered a lot with the CAPS network, focus on this. Add a couple of more with the geometric deep learning. I think this should be enough.
And just for the organization, you have first to go through, for example, this was the original network. So what was the limitation of CNN and why they actually introduced this network? I tried to put this first for all of these chapters. And then at the end, I actually just tried to summarize how they have actually created the why, for example, pooling network with that algorithm, why they did it, and how they did it, and how was the performance. I will probably add the performance in the results section. And similarly, SIGCAPS have used their network, but they have made 2 or 3 modifications. These are the modifications. I tried to organize.
Yeah, I think this is good. This is good. The same, you can follow the same strategy for the geometric, but you know, you don't need to cover like 10 papers in that. Just choose.
For now, I will try one more paper from Capsule Network, and these are basically the one I will try to
so
cover.
So, how many papers you use for the Capsule 4?
It's 4, but I will try to add one more that I just found here.
Yeah, maybe use the same number with the geometric technique as well. 4 or 5 should be more than enough.
Okay, so I'll I found two more papers, but I haven't gone through them. So
mm-hmm.
this one was another one, which is for text-based video segmentation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it will both cover the images
mm-hmm.
and also the video domain.
Videos, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a very good paper. It's from a very good author, so this guy is really famous.
Yeah, this paper is also from this author, VideoCapsNet.
I mean, this guy has really big group.
Okay.
But if you see his name in a paper, that's
I
a very good paper.
I actually try to find it through that way. For example,
mm-hmm.
I try to find through this author and this author,
mm-hmm.
and only the first author was changed in some of the papers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but most of them were.
Yeah, because he's a full professor, so he's like
one.
In the last. yeah, this is a good strategy, and I think you find really, really good sources. So
yeah, I just noted down all the conference names you said, and I just took the papers from them.
Mm.
And luckily, actually, all of these papers were from CBPR or ICIP, all of them, yeah.
That's a good thing. Yeah, so I think you are on track and things are going normal.
I was worried about the structure as well. I mean, if the orientation are fine, so I think that's okay. Because
that's perfect.
Limitation, their modifications, and at the end, how the network
was
designed.
And for example, if you are covering or you are adding a paper, mm-hmm. just try to add, like, for example, the paper you showed me earlier before. Just minimize it. This one, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are discussing this paper, just put the block diagram of this. So
I did that, for example, the previous month.
Yeah.
And I also mentioned that this was figure from this paper.
Yeah, that's fine. But you know, like, whatever method you are discussing, if you put a block diagram
mm-hmm.
for that, I think it's a good thing. It's a very positive thing.
So, block diagram instead of the network?
I mean, like this.
Just
this
one from this paper.
Yeah. One from each, if you can add that.
Most of the papers have, like, multiple diagrams.
Just use the one which is the most meaningful and which give you the top overview. Because, of course, if they are putting multiple, maybe one is the generic one
mm-hmm.
and the other one is like explaining more individual components. You don't need to add the individual one. Just put like the brief overview.
Yeah, for example, this one is the whole network
mm-hmm.
and they have just introduced this capsule pooling algorithm.
Mm-hmm.
So this one was just an explanation of that part.
Yeah, that's good, yeah. Just like that, the same strategy.
Yeah.
Okay, good. And when is the deadline for finishing?
11th.
Oh, okay, it's very short time.
We've had like a lot of projects in this, but I tried to just at least finish few papers. But the problem was, even if I was reading them, I had problems in understanding the core of the problem.
Yeah, I mean, it's totally understandable.
And transformer was too hard, and it had a lot of papers, but
mm-hmm.
I somehow understood the geometric deep learning.
Mm-hmm.
I saw some tutorials to just understand how these things are working.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think at this stage, rather than adding an additional paper to the CAPS network,
mm-hmm.
just try to focus or add 3-4 for the geometric, you know,
okay.
because this is a different topic, and if you add like this, and if you have some time left, then maybe you can add additional papers to the sections, like
okay.
capsule, add the 5th or 6th or whatever,
mm-hmm.
but try to cover these two, like, with some more papers, put the tables, you know, the results, then your report looks like a complete report.
We had a 12-hour exam on 3rd November, but
mm-hmm.
I mean, from 4th to 10th, I mean, I can completely work on that.
Yeah, exactly. Because when we are checking the report, the first thing is like plagiarism,
mm-hmm.
that I already told you, you know, you have to write everything on your own.
I have impressed everything.
That's good. Then the second thing is the structure of the paper should be nice, which is, I think this structure looks quite nice.
Mm-hmm.
Then if you have added like the block diagrams, even though if you just cited them from other papers, it's fine. But if you added them, it's a good indication, you know, that you go through a lot of papers, and the results section. And if this is everything is in place, then I think it's a very good report.
Yeah. I mean, I will let you know then after covering at least a few more papers.
Yeah.
I'll just give you an update.
Perfect.
Thank you so much.
No worries. Okay, so welcome back after the break. We can continue with our building blocks. So we have this. So far, we covered the appearance model, how you can model the appearance for tracking, how you can use detection segmentation for tracking. Now we have come to the third most important component. We also covered the motion model, so that's the third one. This is the fourth one. So what exactly the association is? Association, I told you basically to establish the temporal association between different targets across the frame. So from this association or from this description, you can understand that association is nothing but it's essentially a graph problem, or it could be at least modeled as a graph problem optimally. When it comes to the graph problem, so maybe you have taken in your advanced programming or advanced algorithms courses the graph theory, like what is a edge, what is vertices, what is a fully connected graph, what is tree graph, what is star, you know, like different structure of the graph. What is cyclic graph, what is acyclic graph. Among the different categories of the graphs, the graph that is extremely important or relevant for tracking is called directed acyclic graph. The reason why we are only focusing on the directed acyclic graph is because we should not have loops. Usually when you have a fully connected graph, in fully connected graph, if you want to traverse the fully connected graph, there could be a possibility of having a loop. A loop in tracking domain simply means that a target is going from the future to the past, which is not feasible. I mean, we cannot go from the future to the past. And looping is essentially meaning that. Directed acyclic graph, as the name suggests, it's always directed in one direction. So it is always going from the past to the future. And there is no connection to come from the future to the past. So that's why it is relevant for the tracking tasks. Then how we can use these kind of graphs to do the association. Different kind of techniques we are having. For example, if we talk about the local way or the global way. First of all, this nice illustration can give you some idea. Like, for example, when we want to use a graph structure for the association, so you can have different number of tracks, and each track corresponds to different number of targets. Like, for example, track 1 corresponds to red object, 2 corresponds to, let's say, green object, 3 to, you know, purple or yellow or different kinds of objects. Each object is coded with different color. Then, let's say, in a new frame, like frame T, we have a lot of detection. So the association is how to associate these detection, which is represented in like black dots, to the corresponding tracks. So now you understand, like, this is what we do with the association. So we have tracks, established trajectories of different objects, and then we have the detection at the new frame. So we want to associate these new detection with the track. So the new detection become the part of the track. But which track, that we want to find out with the association. Local association simply means that we use only few frames or two frames to establish the correspondence. So then we have a subcategory of directed acyclic graph that's called the bipartite graph. So these are terms that you may find a lot in the graph theory, but here in tracking we use like that. So directed bipartite graph is a special kind of directed acyclic graph where we want to find the association between only two frames. So how we form the graph? The graph is formed in the form of edges and vertices. So first we want to detect all the objects in the previous frame, then we want to detect all the objects in the next frame. The spatial location of the objects become the vertices, the edges of the graph. And then the connection or the temporal association, like how a given object, like for example in frame T-1, we have this red object, and then the same object is compared with the red object and all the other objects in the next frame. When we are doing these comparisons, like how similar this object is with the other object, we are getting basically a similarity score. And this comparison of the one person or one target with the other targets is done with the form of appearance model. Like you have feature descriptor of one object, you try to compare that with the feature descriptor of other objects, and you get the similarity score. So we try to associate the object with the highest similarity score, and we consider it the same object. So based on the local association, we have a good approach, the Bayesian filtering, which is essentially based on the bipartite graph, where we used a bag of Bayesian filter to associate the targets. And we can use the feature visual features, like the learned features, to model the appearance. And for calculating the similarity, we can either use the Euclidean distance, or we can use the visual features. So earlier we had a question, like how we can use a CNN, whether it will be giving us a real-time performance or not. So the answer for that is this. If you want to use a whole CNN network for extracting the feature vector of a given target, it is time-consuming. We totally agree on that. But we have also checked the different layers of a CNN. We saw that the earlier or the first initial layers are trying to extract the low-level features, and as we are going deeper and deeper in the network, the level of abstraction is getting deeper. When we want to do the association, maybe we don't need to have those high-level features, because those high-level features may be relevant for classification, but for association, we don't need that. So what we can do is basically we can remove the fully connected layer, and we can also remove higher-level layers. You know, basically make your CNN or make your network a little bit shorter, not so deep, not so many layers. That's possible, you can do that, but then there is a big problem with that. Maybe if you coded a CNN, you may have seen that for with every layer, like let's say we have a CNN number one block, and then we have after that we have a pooling. After every CNN, we put a pooling. And what is the idea of pooling? We have to reduce the resolution, because when we are going deeper and deeper in the network, the dimension of the feature maps are getting bigger and bigger. If you are having the same resolution for each feature map, then it will be really difficult to process it. So with every feature map, we are basically trying to reduce the spatial resolution. But the problem with that is if you are removing a lot of high-level layers, you are also removing a lot of pooling layers. So if you, let's say, take a feature vector, let's say from the middle of the network, the dimension of the feature vector will be extremely big. It will be like, you know, maybe in the order of 100 and 1,000, something like that. And then again, we have the problem of how to process this very high dimensional feature vector. So there are techniques to reduce the dimension of the feature vector. This is one of the work that we used, where we used the sparse coding technique to reduce the dimension of the feature vector. Sparse coding is, you can read about it, but it's a technique where we, it's something similar if you are familiar with the PCA. So in PCA, you want to come up with the orthogonal basis, like some basis function, which you can use to reconstruct your signal. So this is something very similar, but it is completely unsupervised. And here we want to use the a dictionary. Like initially, we construct a dictionary. Where in a dictionary, we have individual atoms, like atoms for object number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And each object is represented by a specific number of atoms. Let's say 30 or 40 or 50. It's an empirical parameter. You can define that. And when you want to do the reconstruction of the signal, you can use only the atoms that you put in your dictionary to reconstruct your signal. So with that technique, you don't need to use the whole high-dimensional feature vector for the association, but you can use only the atoms that you learn in your dictionary. And this dictionary can be learned with the optimization techniques like the orthogonal matching pursuit, OPM. The whole idea is of this approach is, I don't want to go to the detail of the individual methods, but the idea is if you want to truncate your network, you will end up with a high-dimensional feature vector, which is difficult to process. So what you can do is you can use a relatively smaller CNN, but then you have to use a feature reduction technique. Like, for example, in this case, we use the sparse coding. And then you have a good feature vector for a given target. And you have a very, the dimension is also very small, so you can process it in real time. And then for tracking, you can use basically the bipartite graph matching. And everything is put in the Bayesian framework, so basically each target is tracked with the Kalman filter or the particle filter, and then it goes or it do the tracking frame by frame. So that's the answer for that question. Like, if you want to have the deep network, you can use it shallow, but then you have to use the feature reduction as well in order to make it real time. Similarly, if you want to use pure deep learning technique. Now, like we define all the individual components of tracking, so we can put everything together. In this technique, the one we introduced, we use basically a CNN in a Bayesian framework. But then, how we can use or how we can come up with a deep network which is doing tracking end to end. So of course we have techniques like deep affinity network, where we can use, for example, VGG. VGG is another popular CNN technique introduced in 2014, but even nowadays people are using it as a backbone architecture. And again, when I say backbone, it's a technique or it's the number of layers that we use only to extract the feature vectors for given target. So at the input of the network, you have your object detection, you detect the bounding boxes. The bounding boxes are given to the backbone. The backbone is basically trying to extract the feature vectors. And at each, for each frame, you get the a kind of matrix where the entries of this matrix is rows, and each row corresponds to the feature vector of one target. Then given that we are doing, or we want to do the association between the frame T and T minus one, so what you want to do is you want to do the concatenation of the different layers. So the features that you extract from frame IT, you try to concatenate that with the feature that you extract at T minus I minus T. Now you have this very high dimension feature vector, like this volume that you are having. I don't think so. Yeah, this one. This is the volume that you are having. On this volume, we apply a compressive network, another CNN network, because CNN network can be used in a very different way. You can use it for compression, you can use it for the dimension reduction as well. And then with this feature, this compression network, what you do basically, you reduce your 3D volume of features into 2D volumes. And you basically come up with this 2x2 matrix. And then in this 2x2 matrix, you want to find the specific location of the object that maximizes the similarity score. And that's how we do the tracking. So here in this technique, we are not relying on the Bayesian filtering or any motion models. We are purely using deep learning techniques for example, feature extraction, then concatenating different feature vectors, then using compression network, basically to compress the feature dimension and getting the highest similarity score. If you are interested, you can read more about this. It's a quite interesting paper for tracking. Similarly, another interesting technique for the multi-object tracking is it's this extension of the Siamese neural network that I introduced earlier, which is using essentially the neighborhood information. So you get the bounding box of one location, and then you get the frame of the object in the next frame, and the network is trying to find the local region to maximize the neighborhood, and then the location which is giving the maximum similarity is essentially your new location for it. So this network, it's using the learned features and the motion model to do the association. So essentially it is using the motion information and the learned features to do the association between different targets. And in order to reduce or to minimize the loss, they are using the triplet loss. That's a quite interesting paper. So these two techniques, like the one that I introduced, which was actually my own paper, the using CNN features with the sparse coding for feature reduction, and then the deep affinity network, and then the Siamese multi-object tracking, these are all based on the association of target using only two frames or few frames. But then I say, that, as I introduced earlier, if you want to do the association, we can also do the association in a global way. And when what do we mean by global way? By global way, we mean that processing the whole video segment, or let's say a couple of frames for tracking. So for example, in this case, let's say you have a video which consists of 10 or 20 frames, and there are three objects which is moving in a scene, and then all the objects are present in all the frames. So we can basically construct a very, very dense graph based on all these frames, and then try to find the trajectories of these objects in the form of traversing this graph. So graph traversing becomes like a tracking problem. In order to do the graph traversing problem, we can model it as model tracking as the minimum cost flow problem. This term is extremely familiar for people who are working in the graph theory. So if you want to have a very complex graph, traversing the graph with the minimum cost. You have a lot of algorithms out there, digestra algorithm, and minimum shortest path algorithm, traveling salesman's problem. All those kind of problems are very relevant for tracking, because you essentially, first of all, you have the frames, you apply your detection based on the spatial location, you localize the different targets in different frames, then based on the spatial location, you construct extremely dense graph, let's say from the whole video segments. Now you have this complex, dense graph. Now the tracking is reduced to traversing the problem, like how you can traverse this graph, let's say for three or four objects. If there are four objects, then you can basically traverse the graph four times, and that will be the trajectories of the objects. One approach that we worked on, the network flow approaches. So if you want to use the whole video segment, let's say for tracking, one of the constraints that I introduced earlier for tracking was any number of target can appear in the scene, and any number of target can disappear from the scene, because it's an unconstrained problem. So how you can model that with the global association model? So for that, we come up with a graph strategy. Here you can see the T1, T2, Tn-1, and Tn. These are the time frames, or these are the frames at given instant, and there are two nodes. Like for example, in T1, you have three nodes. These three nodes corresponds to the spatial location of the objects. Similarly, T2, it corresponds to the spatial location of the objects in the next frame, and then similarly move on with that. But in addition to these frames or timestamps, we have to come up with two additional nodes. We call that a source node and a sink node. What is the meaning of a source node and a sink node? The idea of source node is like a person can come to a scene, a visual scene, at any instant of time. So from where it will come, like for example, if there is only three nodes at T0, how we can add like an additional node at T-n, you know, like you cannot just add it. So in order to model that, we introduce a source node. And the source node is usually like modeled as a kind of a door or an entrance location in a visual scene from where an object can come, and then it comes directly to the given timestamp. Similarly, an object can also move away from the visual scene. So in order to model that behavior, we can have a sync node. And this sync node has to be connected with all the other node, because any object can just go away from a scene at any instant of time. So once you have this complete graph with the source, with the sink, with the different timestamp, we can find the association between different objects and different time instant using the visual features. And then you can use any graph optimization problem. For example, in this case, we use the dynamic programming to optimize the track, and we got quite good tracking results. So this is another technique if you want to use, let's say, the whole video segment to do the tracking. So usually the global approaches, or the approaches where you are trying to use a lot of frames for tracking, is giving much better results, because here you have like a lot of information, a lot of temporal information for the track extraction, compared to the situation where you have only two frames. But at the cost of...
Is it possible to use it in real time?
This one is not real time. Because, you know, you have to process it, you have to construct the graph. However, it can process, or it can do the tracking with a fixed delay. Let's say you define that you want to use 100 frames for your tracking, and then you define your 100 frame window, like 100 frames, one graph, 100 frames, another graph. So there could be an upper bound that you can put it on this 100 frames to process it, and then there will be a fixed delay, you know, like whatever is your frame rate, let's say 30 frames per second, after 30 or 40 milliseconds, you will get the inference of these 100 frames. Then similarly for the next, for the next, for the next. So usually this is not like real time, but this is giving slightly better results than the local approaches, or the approach where we use only two frames. Slightly different approach for tracking based on the energy function. So in this interesting work, or in this interesting paper, the idea is they come up with a cost function, and that cost function is composed of all the individual components that I have introduced so far. So for example, observation, they define it as the detection, and detection is simply by the spatial position of the different objects. So they, in the cost function, you know, like for example, they define it like this. For example, when you have the low energy. Low energy simply means that the detection of individual bounding boxes should be very correspondence with the ground truth. So if you have very small displacement, you have a low energy. But if there is like more displacement, like if you see in the upper left position, if the ground truth is differentiating from the inferred one, then the energy is high. This is for the detection model. Similarly, for the appearance model, there is a component. For a dynamic model, which is essentially kind of the motion model, there is a energy component or cost function component. You have mutual exclusion, there is a component. Target appearance or target persistence, each component has its own contribution in the loss function. So based on that, they come up with the big loss function. It's extremely complex and non-convex function. And each component is also multiplied with some terms. Like, for example, if the appearance term is very important, you can multiply with alpha term, you know, to give it even more importance. Then the dynamic term multiply with beta, something like that. So this is a very nice complex cost function. But the idea is how to optimize that. So they introduce their own strategy that's called the trans-dimensional jump. It's something similar to the backpropagation technique, but they also introduce the dimensional, trans-dimensional jump in order to avoid stucking in the local minima. And once you have basically these optimization done, you can get the trajectories of all the targets for this bunch of frame that you used for coming up with your cost function. So this is completely different. Like, you know, it's not like based on graph or something like that. You basically come up with a cost function. They call it energy function, and then you reduce the energy function to extract the trajectories. Other techniques, interesting different directions, is not using like a kind of a graph traversing problem, but constructing a graph and then finding the trajectories of the graph by using the click problem. Now you may ask me, like, what is a click of a graph? So you have a very big graph. Click of a graph is subgraph of a given graph, but a complete graph. So for example, let's say we have three objects or four objects, we can construct a very dense, fully connected graph. Then from this fully connected, extremely dense graph, we can extract a fully connected graph corresponds to one specific object. And that would become click of the graph. So if you have like four objects, you can extract four clicks. If you have five objects, you can extract five clicks. And each click will correspond to the trajectory of the given target. Now you may ask me, like, how we will know how many clicks I should extract from a given super fully connected graph. You don't need to do that, because you can already define some sort of threshold that if your loss function is minimum than this, then you don't need to extract it. But if it is higher than that, then you continue extracting the clicks. And each click is kind of associating to the trajectory of a given target. This is the visual representation. Like, for example, if you have frame 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 frames, how the clicks looks like and how the fully connected graph looks like. This is the fully connected dense graph. And this is the click, one of the clicks of the graph, which associate to the trajectory of the target in that specific domain. Okay, so having said or discussed these kind of approaches, now I would like to show you some demo videos. If you want to do tracking, so these are the kind of results that you can get in a realistic scenario. Like, for example, this is, I think, a situation in a metro station or an outdoor environment. So technically, you can locate and you can check the behavior or the trajectory of individual targets. You can use it for different domains, like for behavior analysis or detecting, for example, an intruder or pickpocketing or many other techniques if you have a very good, robust tracking technique. This is specifically for surveillance. Yeah. Something more? Usually, in dense situation, like for example in this, you can see that if the situation is quite dense, then using a bounding box as a descriptor or, you know, like a patch extractor will be a little bit difficult because you have a lot of occlusion and, you know, using this kind of representation may be quite prone to noise, because if you extract like the whole bounding box for one object, there is a possibility that it will have a lot of pixels from the other neighboring object or neighboring region. So in order to avoid this kind of problem, in extremely dense situation, we can also use only the head, because you know head is a nice place to track, and instead of focusing on the whole body, we can only focus on the head location, and then based on the head location, we can do the tracking. You can see here, it's a very complex situation, and if you want to use bounding boxes for the whole body, it's a bit difficult, but with only the head location, things become quite nicer. Yeah, recently there is, I would say, a trend of using not the bounding boxes, but exactly the number of pixels that corresponds to the object for tracking. So this is a kind of classical way of initially doing the segmentation of the object and then using the segmentation results to do the tracking. So with this technique, I think we can get a better tracking result, because we are focusing only on the pixels that corresponds to the object, but not the bounding boxes. Yeah, so more results from the pics, where we don't focus on the pixels or the bounding boxes, but we focus on the individual key points, the 6 key points that I introduced earlier, and then based on that, we only use these key points to do the tracking. Yeah. Some more insight. So once everything is in place, like for example, you have the key point detection algorithm, you have the tracking algorithm, you can do very nice tracking. But now, how you can use this tracking data for some meaningful tasks, like for example, how you can use that for breeding purposes, for the behavior analysis. So this is a real example, again, from the data that we get from the pig farm. And here the idea is you can track the animals like for a whole week, or let's say for the whole month. And then for each animal, we can see how much an animal has walked in this day, or how much an animal has walked in 1 week. So we can find out which animal is the most active, which is the animal that is lying most of the time, like, you know, the least active one. What is the animal that has paid most visit to the feeding station? You see this location, this enclosure, that's the feeding station. They go inside to eat and also drink. So we can find out which animal is most frequent going to the feeding station, which is like eating more. In addition to that, we can also find out what is the aggressive animal, because when they are like doing tail biting, that's a very negative behavior. So all those attributes, active, limeness, sick, feeding, those kind of simple behavior, you can essentially extract it from the tracking data. So in this particular situation, no animal can go out from the enclosure unless it is sent to the slaughterhouse. So yeah, but you're right. I mean, this is one scenario, but of course we can have the tracking failures. And by tracking failures, I mean like maybe in one day we give them one ID and the next day we give them another ID. So it happens if you rely purely on the visual data. But in this situation, if you focus carefully, they are tagged on the ear. So that's basically an RFID tag. So we use basically there is an RFID antenna in the feeding station. So we can use that information to correct the mistakes. So, you know, we don't need to, because if you have these kind of failures specifically for the breeding purposes, then you lose a lot of information. It's not very useful. So we use basically a combination of multiple techniques to get the robust one. Yeah?
So, for instance, if you want to measure or you want to know something about the body temperature of the animals, but could you also use infrared information or an infrared camera in addition?
Maybe, but...
That was just an idea.
I think it...
Sensor who is detecting
Yeah, I think it's more than possible to have this kind of cameras and then behavior check the temperature, let's say. But in the current form they are having, they are using only the RGB camera. It's actually, we have the sample cameras in 257. It's the Elotech cameras. But recently we also wrote a proposal. The camera manufacturer, the Elotech, they recently come up with a like another sensor, which is based on radar, and that can be used to monitor the breath speed, like how fast or how slow they are breathing, and also the heart rate. So they want to use now the heart rate and the breathing to like monitor how they are. But that sensor is not like installed in the station yet, like in Hammer barn. So it's not installed yet, but that's the plan. Like if the project is funded, then we are planning to do that. But I think this RFID is also interesting, but probably the reason they didn't install it maybe is the cost. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I'm not expert in cameras, but probably it's a bit expensive. That's why. But the camera they are having now, it's actually 4K. So very, very good high resolution cameras. Yeah, so how to use tracking for breeding? So that's the practical example. In addition to that, maybe you know this, that Norway is one of the famous country in exporting oil. But the second export of Norway is salmon. It's extremely important and brings billions of dollars to the economy. So aquaculture is extremely important. And then how we can use tracking and computer vision to facilitate the aquaculture industry. So for example, we can use the tracking algorithms for fish counting, density estimation. These two tasks, like the fish counting and density estimation, is extremely important for the aquaculture industry. That is mostly based on the western coast of Norway. So they actually design specific sensors and specific hardware to do that. But for example, we can use simple RGB camera to do the tracking of the animal. This is one of the examples that you can see. The figure below, it's actually, this is a video that is recorded from Mjøsa Lake here in Jøvik, the Mjøsa Lake you have. So there is a company, they have like a camera infrastructure. So you can see there's a lot of fishes, very good fishes. And this task is actually, we wanted to find out the frames where there is most of the fishes, because the camera is always there, there's already recording, and then in most cases, like, most of the frames are empty, so we don't want to process that. So in this simple task, we wanted to find what are the frames where there are fishes or most of the fishes. So, you know, we can use these tracking and techniques that I introduce for density estimation, for growth monitoring, for health monitoring, and also for the feed efficiency in the farm as well and also in the wild.
But I assume you need multiple cameras across the lake at different locations?
Very good question. So I was working, not working, but like one example, the way they are doing the density estimation, usually that's like for the farms where they have these enclosure setting. So how to do, for example, the their task was actually to calculate the length of the fish. So it's really difficult because you see that's a very complex situation. So the way they did it is basically they created like a kind of a window in the farm, and then fishes usually like try to travel, they love to travel from one side to another. So if the fish is like traveling like from this side to this side, so while they are moving, they calculate the density as well, and they calculate the length as well. And then they also keep track of like, so this is one technique as well. In the wild, I think, yes, it will be a little bit difficult, because the second video, that's Mjøsa, so we don't have any control. Anything can happen. But this one, we just can like wanted to find out what are the informative frames and what are the less informative frames. And I think in this video from Mjøsa, we also can see some of the fishes has some laces, like they have this problem of laces. You can see it in the from the frames. Like so I think this can also be used to monitor like what is the population in Mjøsa, which is like, you know, healthy and laces free and whatever like that. Yeah, more examples. So performance analysis, basketball sprint, you know, you can just see, track the person, then find the trajectories of the person to see whether he is doing well or he is not doing well, or how it could be improved, because these kind of tracking techniques could be used to give feedback or to at least train the athletes like how they can run faster or how they can do a better goal. So it can be used for that. Currently, it can also be used in immersive application. Like, for example, if you are having this VR set, then if they have this embedded algorithms, you can only use the VR to track the objects, you know, without basically doing tracking algorithms on your TV or something. So it has application in that. Now, just to conclude the talk, so there are modern ways of doing things and there are old ways of doing it. So I think it's good to follow or to be smart and follow the modern techniques. But then the question is, we should use deep learning for everything, for every application. So I think it's not, because deep learning is good. It's giving good results. If some preconditions are fulfilled, like, for example, you have good amount of data, the data is annotated, you don't have any ethical issues with that. So in that situation, yes, it can be used. But if you don't have any good data, or, you know, maybe you can use some other classical approaches, it can also give you better results. What are the technologies or techniques that can revolutionize tracking or make it like even more widespread in our community? So, for example, we have the 5G infrastructure technologies, the IoT technologies. These tracking algorithms could be, you know, extremely useful if we connect everything with the internet. So if you have a robot that is cutting the grass, you can monitor it from your mobile phone. And, you know, those kind of technologies, it can be extremely useful. Similarly, the camera resolution that you had 5-10 years ago and compared to the one we have now, as I said, for the pic tracking, we have 4K cameras. Before 10 years, maybe we have like not even 720p. So the resolution is getting better. Improved network infrastructure that can also be very helpful to come up with a nice tracking techniques and, you know, facilitating the tracking algorithms. And then in addition to the those, we can also search algorithmic aspect of tracking as well, like, for example, biologically inspired approaches for tracking, how the insect and birds are moving, you know, some, for example, particle swarm optimization specifically for tracking. That could be quite interesting. In addition to that, currently, if you want to do tracking, like, for example, in the pig situation, we are doing tracking using only the visual information, but if there is a mistake or if there is a failure, we use the RFID tag to correct that. But, you know, it could be extended to other sensors as well, like we can use radars, we can use other heterogeneous sensors to come up with a very nice and robust tracking. So, yeah. One thing more, so most of the technique that I introduced here, it is based on the completely supervised learning, which needs actually fully annotated data. But nowadays, we have quite interesting self-learning and unsupervised learning technique as well, which is trying to leverage on the, you still of course need labeled data, but with unsupervised learning and self-learning, you try to leverage on the unlabeled data that is usually available in a very huge amount. So those kind of approaches could also be very interesting in exploring this direction. Okay, so with this, let's conclude my presentation. If you guys have any question, please go and ask. Some references that we used in this talk. Yep, thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Questions? No questions. Okay. I'm surprised, but then there are no questions.
Was it very interesting or very boring? Thank you.
So, as we agreed, just make some notes on the particular slides.
Yeah, the unpublished one.
Progress.
Yep.
And I uploaded it then on the Blackboard.
Yep.
Yes, otherwise, we meet again tomorrow, 10:15.
So, do we have lectures next week? Or?
I have one lecture scheduled. Tuesday. is online. So I just need to confirm that, and then as we did it last time online, there's no point to come here. But I keep you informed and updated. But tomorrow and tomorrow, two lectures are on campus as usual.
This file size will be quite big because there is a lot of demo videos.
Yeah.
Presentations. So I will share the link to the drive link.
Okay.
You can use that to download it.
Okay. Very good. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye.
Yeah. Ahora, mami, llama, ¿cómo se llama?